is John.
This is Wes.
And this is Ryan.
And this is the Nintendo Show, the best damn Nintendo podcast on the internet. We're back, fellas.
Yeah.
We took a week off.
Sure did.
We did.
Yeah,
kind Although of. It doesn't feel like a week off.
No?
I feel like my bones hurt.
What happened to your bones? Do you have bonitis?
I do.
Mm. It's my one regret.
He has a calcium deficiency.
No, I just work with.
That's odd because he's never not eating cheese. I always see him eating cheese.
His body can't process it though; it just goes right through his digestive system.
Gotcha. Yeah.
So, I mean, the cheese that comes out of me is just exactly as it went in.
What if? Fascinating. What if we like grafted metal onto your skeleton? That way, your bones are strong.
Oh, there we go. Yeah, that's how you do it.
Mm-hmm. We're gonna science the shit out of you. How you guys been? It has been like 2 weeks since we've been in the same room.
Yeah.
You guys doing all right?
Well enough, I suppose. I went to a football game yesterday.
It's been that long? 2 weeks?
Yeah. Yeah, because we skipped a week. So it was two weeks ago.
We didn't do the Pokemon show.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny because like we were like all wondering, what are we going to do for the Pokemon show? There isn't really anything. And then they dropped two trailers and have a event distribution. We'll talk about them another time.
Yeah.
But yeah. So this is the mini show, not the Pokemon show. So we're going to talk about whatever we feel like. We're going to talk about Wes's strange issues with cheese and his peculiar body.
Yeah. That also kind of comes out of my pores.
Yeah.
Kind of like very tiny shredded cheese.
So you're like a organic fondue maker.
Essentially.
Huh. That's gross. That's just...
So what you're telling me is that if you rolled around in roast beef, you'd have essentially a Philly cheesesteak?
Yeah.
All right, let's put this one in the trash.
What's happening?
Let's dump this one. Dump the audio on this.
I'm
moving on.
So it's the mini show. We'll talk about whatever. Like, I have some games.
Sure.
How about you guys? You got any games on tap?
I got
a game to talk about. Yeah.
One.
Okay.
I saw a movie.
Nice.
I saw a couple movies actually. One
okay.
One new one.
I've been watching a couple of shows. We can talk about that as well.
I saw one.
I do have a few games that I can close the book on, because I've actually finished off a bunch of games in the past couple of days.
You did.
I finished off Tunic. That's one that we both played. Ryan, you finished it too. You finished it when we did the official show a couple of weeks ago.
Now that you've crossed the finish line, how do you feel?
I like it. I think it has a lot of the issues that you were talking about before. Where the bosses, you know, most of the bosses have like... 3, maybe 4 attacks at the broadcast, and once you learn the pattern, it's not really all that tough. It's just that they're such damage sponges. They take so much just rounds to hit. And especially there's the one in that factory zone.
With the two robot guys? Is it the fight before the two robot? There's like a mini boss where it's like two of those, what do you call it?
They're
like monolith sentinel dudes.
There are those two, and then there's the one kind of like he looked like a prospector leader guy. He like a hammer and he threw bombs at you. Mm-hmm. That guy, because like his window to hit him was so small, like I was only able to get like one chip shot in, and then he started moving around again. Like, okay, well now it's time to avoid damage, and then maybe in a few seconds get another chance for a little chip shot, and then just avoid damage. So I don't know. I think. There are a lot of things about the game that I like. I like that the world that they created in here. I like the whole like light world, dark world thing where, you know, you get to the end and you realize that the Heiress, this entity that you're trying to, I suppose, save, ends up fighting you and you lose. And you kind of get like this ethereal form and you have to go through the entire world and sort of collect all of your power-ups again, and you get like that teleport dash, which
really
opens
cool
up a lot
dash,
of them.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That is a lot of fun.
And I also like how they start to keep track of things for you. Like, they'll tell you like how many pages you have left to get. And, you know,
did you get them all by the time you ended your run?
I did get them all by the time I ended the run. I was really surprised when they finally started tracking those things for you, when I only had like 3 pages left to get. I'd collected a lot more than I thought I had. And then when I got to, like, the very end of the game, I collected all my power-ups back. I was in, like, my regular form. Then you can switch between, like, night and day to collect more stuff. And I was like, okay, well, let's take a look at a guide and see what sort of things that I missed. And I only missed 3 pages, of course. I only missed one of the power up. There's like a mushroom that enhances your MP, and that was the only power up that I had missed. So I thought that was really cool that they were able to scatter these things and findable. But
I remember, yeah, there was a point where I just looked up. There's 23 of them mm-hmm. total, and I just looked them up, and I was like, all right, where are all they? And I was very happy that I kind of got all of them. Like, I mean, I feel like I had gotten most of them. There were a couple I didn't care about getting. You know, that I didn't feel like were necessary, but
yeah. The are you talking about the passive cards?
Yeah, the ones that you feed mm-hmm. back to the save shrine, and then it sort of gives you like an attack, right. a defense. There's an MP, a magic damage buff,
right?
Health, and
so there's those, and then there's also like those cards, like the scavenger mask, the one you basically have to equip in certain areas.
Yes.
Okay. There's,
I remember talking about that with you guys, where I was like, the entire time I used three of them. I used exclusively three. One that was just a fast walk, one mm-hmm. that gave you a little bit of HP for killing bad guys, and then the mandatory, well, at least I felt like it was mandatory, yeah. unless you intend on ever taking damage. The one where it stops that purple stuff from damaging you.
Yeah.
I buried the lead on that. Because I didn't tell you about that. I remember trying to keep that one under wraps.
Yeah, and they hide that passive equipable skill, essentially. Yeah. Behind all this stuff. Mm-hmm. So there's all that, like, that purple pink shit that will deplete your maximum HP. And so, yeah, that one's pretty much mandatory to use. I looked up how many of those there were throughout the game, and I'd found all but two of them. One of them that I hadn't come across was the actual walking speed one. So that was a nice one to finally get.
Oh, yeah, that one's, I think, one, it's just nice to be able to simply move faster because your character is kind of slow. And two, there is kind of just a natural benefit in battle to just being a little bit faster. There's probably a lot of stuff that you just can naturally run out of the attack and strike zone of rather than trying to waste your rolls and stuff like that.
Well, because when you do your dodge roll, of course, depletes stamina. But when you do your dodge roll and it goes into your sprint, if you're holding down the button, you know, your character is a bit more clumsy. It's a bit more unwieldy, which makes sense. Like, you're running at a faster speed, so it's not quite as snappy. You're not hitting your target maybe in the way that you would if you were being more judicious with your movements. So it is nicer just to have a better default moving speed. And then the other thing I looked up is in order to get, I think it's like the cover art, or maybe it's the very back page, the basically the last page that you need to get, there's this other scavenger hunt that you have to do in these really obscure hints that they drop in the instruction manual. So basically, you know how there's maybe four or five of these doors that have like a little design on them throughout the world. They're mostly like on cliff sides. And then you like walk up to them and use the D-pad to input like basically the tracing of the path on the door, and the door opens up.
Yeah.
So there are these other, they call it the Golden Cross in the instruction manual. The Golden Cross is basically your D-pad. Throughout the instruction manual, there are also these tiny little like designs, sometimes hidden, like to kind of use a mix of metaphor between the lines in all the instruction manuals, where they'll like have like these golden squares, and you're supposed to like associate this particular design on the page of the instruction manual with an area of the map that you're supposed to walk to. And then that maybe there's a flower, or maybe there's like a design on the wall, and then you have to use the D-pad to trace that design as well. And then a chest will appear, and it'll have a little fairy inside. And when you've collected 10 of those, there's a maximum of 20. When you've collected 10 of them, they'll award you the final page of the instruction manual. And when you have the final, I guess we've gone well into spoilers at this point. When you have that final page of the instruction manual and you go to fight the final boss, you don't actually engage in a fight. Like the heiress will go to attack you, and you'll basically like be holding out the complete instruction manual, and the heiress will like look at the instruction manual and be so like inspired by the knowledge that you've gained. They'll be like, okay, cool, roll credits. You win.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah. I thought it was a pretty nice reward for going through like this huge pain in the butt scavenger hunt. I don't know why anyone would put themselves through like actually trying to decipher this without like a guide, because like this, of all the obtuse things that this game does, finding all these hidden treasure chests with fairies in them, really fucking obtuse.
I can see that, yeah. Yeah, and I think my ending, I don't know how many versions of the ending you are there are in the game, but as I recall my ending, having missed, I think, 7 pages, which is actually kind of quite a few pages, but was something to the effect of, yes, I freed her, but now I'm the one trapped in the thing.
Right, it's kind of like a Hollow Knight sort of ending.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's the ending I got in Hollow Knight. I did not go for the good ending in that game.
Yeah. But again, I think aside from just a subjective opinion that I don't really like that grindy boss battles where they got the tiny window and I got to sit there and dodge for 15 minutes. Mm. Aside from just simply not really enjoying the boss fights themselves, which are fine for what they are, I love the game.
Yeah.
It's gorgeous. It's fun to play. It's fun to explore the world. The soundtrack is really, really good. So I dug it. I thought it was an awesome game.
Yeah, and they do a good job of, like, when you get a new power-up, a new skill, there's almost always something you can go back and find. So it's really fun just to go back through areas you've gone to before, like once you get all your power-ups, just to find like all the extra like treasure chests and stuff.
Yeah.
If you want to find all the golden coins, and the golden coins that you take to the wishing well that'll allow you to equip more passive skills. Like, there's a new game plus, mm-hmm. so you don't have to go for the best ending on the first time through if you don't feel like it. Yeah, cool game. Mm-hmm. Thumbs up. Wes, you got one? Tag in.
I grabbed Potions Permit.
Nice. Which, that's a new game.
It is a new game, which I don't know if I like this game or not.
Hmm.
I mean, I like it enough to keep playing it and see if I like it, which I have put a pretty good chunk into it already, so I feel like I should already have decided if I like it or not. I like it enough. It's fine.
Put it in the box.
Yeah, it's fine. It's a very kind of like a slice of life kind of game where it's not about the combat, and it's mostly just about just day-to-day life in this village. There's not a whole lot going on, really, which there isn't a overall objective or anything. It just starts out with the mayor calling for help because his daughter's sick, and then, which there was like no urgency to it at all at the beginning as well. It's like, please come to this my town. I need you to heal my daughter. And then like 4 days later, you actually see the daughter. Like, you're in the town for like 4 days doing stuff. And you're like, oh yeah, this chick. I forgot all about her. It was weird. But a lot of the game is really a lot of gathering resources that over and over and over again. And there's a lot of games that do that, except it's the exact same resources in the exact same locations because they repopulate every single day. So just every day it's just like, all right, I gotta go make my round through the forest and gather all these resources and then go do my whatever in the town that I gotta do and then rest for the day and then go do it again. I guess I should just start about with the premise of the game. So I'm bad at these. So the premise of this game is that you're a, I don't know, apothecary or whatever, I don't know. And you have
a chemist.
A chemist. And
you make methamphetamine in Arizona.
Yeah. And you're just there. You have this little clinic, and these patients show up. And
you are the danger.
Yeah. And you're supposed to like fix up the townspeople and whatever. But
you're the one who knocks.
It's kind of like the thing, like the core thing of the game is fixing up these people in your clinic, but you see like one patient every 4 days or so.
Okay.
And it only takes less than 5 minutes to take care of the patient. So you're like, this core thing of the game, you don't do a lot. So it's a lot of building up relationships with the townspeople through talking to them and giving them gifts that you get through healing people.
Billing their insurance.
Yeah, exactly. And then
making sure they have an open access plan as opposed to an HMO. Mm-hmm.
They have a friendship meter, and when the meter's filled, eventually you'll get a quest for that villager to open up the next meter.
The next stage of friendship.
Yes, yeah, stage of friendship to, I guess, get another quest. And they're usually like little weird quests. Like I did, there was this pirate chick, and her quest was you need to get this particular meat that you get from fishing. So I had to like catch 20 fish and get this meat, and it took a minute. There was another one where I had to make a particular ointment to help this guy have sore shoulder. It's just weird stuff, and it's
so
it's
as a like, reward for gaining their friendship, you get to do chores for them.
Yeah, exactly. And they just pop up with weird things that you need to do, and it's a lot of like weird small I don't even want to call them mini games, but essentially it's like when you have a person to in your clinic, they tell you my right leg hurts, and so you get like this outline of a person, and you move a magnifying glass and you just hover over the right leg until you find the spot, and then you have to diagnose it. And diagnose is like you get this weird little rhythm game where you have these inputs moving across the screen, you have to hit them at the right point. And if you do that well enough, you diagnose it and you increase their rating, their satisfaction with their service.
Okay, is that like increase the friendship meter?
No.
Oh.
It just increases.
Does like it increase the amount of money you make?
I'm guessing. I don't know. I haven't gotten anything less than perfect. Okay. It's wow. Super easy.
Well, it's, professional gamer.
Well, you know me. You know me.
If you get less than perfect, you know, reset, new file.
So you figure out what it is, and then you go back to your house and you brew up a potion, and you get like a set amount of different potions in the beginning recipes. And all it is it's a grid, and some of the grid is shaded in, and you need to fill that with ingredients. And each ingredient has a different amount of blocks that they can fill in. And different ingredients fall under four different categories: fire, earth, water, and
heart.
What was it? Earth, fire, earth, water, wind.
Wind, I guess.
Wind, yeah. And so far, all the like stuff to make to like heal the clinic or whatever, you can use whatever. So it's weird that right, you so even had a distinction.
You showed me this, and actually, some of it looked familiar because a lot of this game reminds me of what I played of Atelier Ryza. Mm-hmm. So when you're crafting something, it will like limit you. Like, you can craft this potion, but you can only use ingredients with the elemental properties of fire or the elemental properties of water. However, everything you were showing me that you could craft was just like you use any elements you want. You didn't have a limit to start out with.
The only time that I've seen it limited is with quest related stuff you had to make. Like, I had to make some kind of bug spray to like clear out bugs in this area. I think that one was limited to only two different ones. And there's only been a few things that do that. So it's just a weird mechanic to have in there. But you're also only allowed to use like a certain amount of ingredients to solve the thing as well. Like, you have this grid and shaded out, but you only can use like five ingredients. So if you don't pick the right shapes to fill it in, then
like a 10 grams puzzle where you have to like every ingredient will have a shape associated with it as well as an element, and you have to make sure that the ingredients that you're picking fill in the requisite shape on the grid.
Exactly. And it's the one interesting thing that they do is that after you make a potion five times, you can start saving recipes. Mm. So instead of like refilling in the grid every time, you can just select the recipe. It'll show you how many of those particular ingredients that you had used for that recipe. And you can just quick make a batch of them, like a bunch of them. It's a weird game. It's very resource heavy in order to move on. Like, it takes a lot of resources to like unlock the next area or to upgrade the house, and a lot of gold, and it's very slow in the beginning to get going and get momentum. But it's very, I don't know, there's no big overall objective. It's just a weird little...
It says here that you may even find yourself growing particularly close to certain bachelors or bachelorettes.
Oh.
So Wes.
Well, I mean, I already sparked something up with that pirate lady who has a hook for a hand, so... Mm-hmm. You know, yeah.
Oh yeah,
yeah.
Oh yeah.
Those hooks, yeah. And after you did that, she told you a story about how she lost her hand. You're like, all right, like it's just, I was fighting people, my hand got chopped off, but I was protecting my people. I was like, this is a little intense, lady. Like, this is...
You were just making a run to Target.
I was just handing you some fish. I don't understand.
Yeah, that a lot of this game, it looks like they did a pretty good job of keeping it to where you're like always churning things, like you're always engaging in the loop of gathering materials and using materials. And I think that's probably why they keep it open. Like your ingredients will allow you to use any sort of element at the beginning, is because it seems like they want you to be just grabbing everything you can.
Yep.
And then as you get further in the game and you've engaged with the systems more, then they'll get a little bit more particular about what you're supposed to be doing. Probably. Maybe. We'll see.
It's a very slow-paced game. It's a very chill thing. There's a lot of little subtle things I find interesting, like just different, like you'll be running down a road, and there's a couple of dirt spots in it, so you'll hear your feet on the stone, and then you'll hear it squish into the dirt, and it's very subtle how it does little things like that. It's a very...
There's also a day-night cycle. So I think how the game strikes me is that they kind of expect you to like maybe play through a day or two and then stop. Because of the way you, like, you're telling me, like, how you have to, like, eat food to keep your health up.
The days don't take long. That's the thing. They're very quick. And when you get through, like, even just resource gathering, you've lost half the day. And you do any, like, the jobs that you can do. Like, you can packages at the mail guy. That burns 2 hours. Because just doing that mini game, you'll get, like, 200 and some gold, and it'll burn 2 hours of the day. So days you kind of go through quick. So it's more like go through a week at a time than move on to something else in your actual life.
It's interesting that you're the pharmacist as well as the part-time jack-of-all-trades.
Yeah, the mailman keeps asking me to deliver stuff for him. I was like, no, that's your fucking job. Like, what are you doing?
You deliver the mail. I make the drugs.
I mean, they do make the time worth it. Like, certain shops only open at certain times of the day. Each shop has a day of the week that they're closed.
Oh, yeah, they all got to go and gather material, too.
Yeah, at night, people end up in the tavern. People come and go through the tavern.
As they do.
There's a random whack-a-mole arcade game. I don't know why it's there.
Yeah, why not?
Two tries, I got the max score. So I'm like, all right, done with this forever.
Professional gamer over here. Like,
come on. But, you know, it's... The mayor's name is Meyer. Meyer the mayor.
Perfect.
All right.
Well done.
And every single time I see him, I go, Maya!
Like Goldie Wilson. Mayor Goldie Wilson.
Yep.
Nice.
Progress is his middle name.
Yeah. I see a concern about that kid that won't be able to start a tab unless he orders something.
You want a Pepsi, you're going to pay for it.
I want a Pepsi free.
It's a fun game.
Back to the Future. Maybe it's from the 80s. Wow. Wonderful.
It's a chill game. It's, you know.
You ever wonder, like, I haven't wondered before. I'm wondering now what it is, like, people who are younger than this, like 10, 15 years younger than this, what is their, like, touch point movie that they'll just pull quotes from?
Rain of Fire.
That's a good one.
I don't know, probably like fucking Avengers movies or something. Everyone's so casual these days. The normies. I have no idea. I don't know what people like anymore. So, like, just in the minds of my own interest, like, it's, I don't know what people even
mostly
like.
Just reference memes and TikToks. Like, I got a coworker that just, he'll just blurt something out that's completely random. He's like, oh, yeah, I guess you didn't see that meme. I'm like, no.
No, I was busy doing my job, living life. I was
doing my job, or playing Potions Permit. Come on, man, I got things to do.
I hope he finds a coworker that will share his interest one day. I got one more. I got another one real quick that'll burn through. I finished off Xenoblade 3. Big thumbs up. Really enjoyed it. Once you beat it, it does then unlock some other side quests. There are certain quests that you can't access until you finish off the game. But I pretty much explored every area that I could get to in the game, except for maybe a couple, and then running those areas, finished all the side quests. There is one character. And Wes, did you ever get to like the sea captain guy?
Nope.
Spoilers, there's a sea captain guy.
Cool. I'm on board.
Is he missing your hand?
No, I don't
think
he
is. Ruined opportunity. Because that would have been awesome. Like, their weapon that you get is you lose a hand.
That would be great, by the way, if like there was like a mini game where you had to explain to this pirate woman that you simply cannot give her a hand back, that you're a chemist, but you can't just regrow her hand, and then she just sobs for like you have to hit the button A for maybe 10 minutes to get through just her wailing and crying.
Just the despair that she has of having lost his appendage.
Yes.
Like, I'm a chemist, not an alchemist. But this sea captain, he's to use Final Fantasy terms of Blue Mage, and he's got enemy skills.
That's cool.
Fight other enemies. And this is a character where I think that in order to unlock like the final quest and like totally like max out affinity with the colony that he's associated with, you have to be engaging in these quests where you're like learning the enemy skills. And I tried a few times to like you have to refight tyrant bosses in order to learn the skills from them. And it keeps a nice list for you. Like, hey, this is a skill that you can learn. This is who you learn it from. And it'll tell you if you've beaten them or not. So you know, like, if you have to just, like, look at your landmarks or the gravestones for these bosses. Like, they make it really friendly. I tried it a couple of times to, like, refight these bosses with him in the party to see if I could get him learning these new skills. And I couldn't never get it to work. So I missed something there. And I probably could have just looked it up. But there were so many other quests to do that I was eventually was like, okay, well, it's been 160 hours. I think I'm going to go put a pin in this game for a while.
Come on, Blue Mage Sea Pirate Captain? Come on, let's go.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you can have, like, your whole team, like, get this class eventually. And I'll just be sea captains together and get on
your boat. Well, there only can be one captain. I mean, that's just anarchy.
Yeah, that's the best part of... You take turns. It's a sort of like...
Oh, you pass the hat. You're captain this week.
It's like an anarchist commune. You take in turn like to be sort of like executive officer captain for like a week. But, you know, all the decisions of the captain have to be like ratified by a majority vote. Unless in case of like foreign affairs, in which case it's going to be a 2/3. But I thought this through. Right? I know exactly what will happen when we're all sea captains
together. Yeah, I see the spreadsheet behind you on the whiteboard, John. I understand.
Uh-huh. And it's very confusing. You see like the spreadsheet, like Uni is the top character because she's the best one.
I mean, it looks like Charlie from Sunny Day when he started filling out the mailing.
Who's also the voice of Luigi in the Mario movie.
Oh, is he?
Oh, yeah.
That's great.
Did you guys see that? We saw Luigi in the trailer. He was running from Dry Bones. That was a highlight.
Yeah, that was good.
Did you guys like the trailer in general?
I'm on board.
Yeah, same.
I think it was good.
Yeah.
I think like the big controversy is like the Chris Pratt voice, because he's basically doing his Chris Pratt voice.
Yeah, like, he doesn't sound like Mario.
I think like there's a part where he like says Mushroom Kingdom, here we come, like maybe there's a touch of like a faded Brooklyn accent. I don't know. Like, I didn't really care what he was going to sound like. There, I think there's a lot of speculation in certain communities about like if he was going to try to do a voice, if it would just be his voice, what it was going to be. I never expected anything other than him just sounding like Chris Pratt, because that's like when you cast him, you're casting him to be the role. I think it would have been, I really like Charles Martinet. He's done a lot of really great things with the voices for a ton of different Mario characters. He does the voices for, of course, like Luigi and Toad and all these different characters, Wario and Waluigi. I think it would have been very annoying to sit through a 90-minute movie listening to Charles Martinet doing the squeaky Mario voice for 90 minutes. Like, I think that would have really worn on people's nerves.
See, I see that Mario doesn't have the accent. I hope Charlie Day does the accent for Luigi. It just doesn't make any sense.
Like Keegan-Michael Key is doing the voice for Toad. He's actually putting on a voice for Toad.
That's fun.
And he sounds really good.
Yeah.
Jack Black sounds really good as Bowser. I really like that opening sequence with Bowser and fighting the penguins. Like, now you have tasted our fury. I thought that was a really great opening. I think it looks really good.
Yeah.
Ryan, you got something for us?
I have a video game
to discuss. Let's do it.
I kind of teased it a little bit because I'd only been playing it for, I don't know how many, a couple of hours, I guess. But I've been playing more of Sinking City, and I think I'm prepared to give you, like, you know, not even a hot take, a well-cooked take.
Let's do it.
So, first off, recommended?
For sure. For sure, I would recommend this game. I think I paid, like, $7 for it, too. This game is kind of a doomed game from the get-go. Just a little bit about it. It's a Lovecraftian survival horror game that has a sort of detective angle to it, an open world exploration detective angle. It's made by a company called Frogware. Apparently Frogware's previous to this had made a bunch of well-received Sherlock Holmes games that I imagine follow this formula very closely, probably just with less survival horror stuff and probably more puzzles. It's a couple of other things happened. Like, the studio that originally was creating it had this kind of infighting, and then another branching studio kind of decided to make their own game about Lovecraft called Call of Cthulhu that was released like within a month of this game.
I remember that.
And the game did terribly, so it reviewed poorly. It didn't sell particularly well. It's also a first person game. From what I saw of the clips of it, it's nothing like Sinking City, aside from them both looking generally similar and, of course, being about Lovecraft and being detective games. So it kind of, it sucks because it has to kind of carry the baggage of this other game that isn't particularly good. And on top of that, when they released it, it was an exclusive for some kind of gaming platform. Is it Epic Games?
Okay.
I think Epic Games had just launched.
That happens. Epic Games will get like the rights for X amount of months.
So just because of that, the game, a lot of the reviews that if you go back and read got astroturfed pretty hard of people that were basically just saying Epic Games should fail. And shame on anyone for doing business with them.
Yeah, I think they got like the rights, like Borderlands, like one of the Borderlands was also like an exclusive with Epic Games for a while, and then it got released.
Yeah.
Like weird. Yeah, Epic Games is weird.
So it seems like, it, especially if you go back, because this game came out, I think, in 2019, so it's been out for a while, and then it was, even on the Switch, it came out in 2000, or it came out last year.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm kind of catching up on this game, just because I got it on a really good sale. This is typically a AAA title game, it's typically $60. Not anymore, I think the regular retail price is probably like $39 or $40, but again, I got it for $7, it was like a 75% off.
I looked it up out of curiosity. You can get off Amazon for $30 for PS4.
Okay, yeah. So that's kind of what I would have expected it. So just taking this game on its own merits, regardless of this cloud of weirdness that exists outside of the game itself, this game is really, really good, and it's a lot of fun. I think that they've made this really big world that you get to explore. It is so creepy and eerie, especially, I mean, if you like Lovecraft, you're going to love this kind of environment that they put you in. It feels so true to the text. And if you've never heard of or never understood what H.P. Lovecraft was, what his deal was, this is a really great way to just kind of dip your toe in the water. If you start like listening to an audiobook or just start reading his text and you're like, my God, this is dry. This is just so dense. Then a game like this might really get you into the mood to then go back and read the text and kind of make sense. Because that's kind of,
have you read it?
Yeah, I love H.P. Lovecraft stuff.
Yeah, okay.
That's typically your stories from him will be like, the first half of it will be so fucking dry. And just sort of like a procedural would be, with the characters occasionally basically just telling you, like, you cannot, like, I can't even make you comprehend what it is that I've experienced. And then usually it's the 2/3 mark where it's like, then horrific things kind of start to happen, or you really start to get this sense of the insanity of what's going on. And then by the tail end of it, it's just fucking crazy. It is just so fucking crazy. Like, I'm trying to think of some good examples. Like one of his Mountains of Madness, and in it you're basically being told about a guy who made this voyage, and he's the sole survivor of it, and he's sort of relaying what happens and how everyone kind of lost their minds, and it's so weird. And then you get to the end of it and it's like, yeah, this giant elder god inside of a mountain has summoned these giant penguin monsters that are worshipping him and have contorted the minds of everybody that was part of it, and they all died. And it's like, you don't know that that's happening. You think you are reading.
Penguin monsters?
Yeah, there's a...
Who would you want worshipping you?
There's always an aquatic angle to H.P. Lovecraft's writing. Like, that's what the kind of... These half-human, half-fish people, they get contorted by
penguins are disease. Birds.
Yeah, I should say they are. You're right. That is correct. They are, in fact, birds. But there's this aquatic animal. So anyway, back to this game. It is essentially a detective game. So you go around and you uncover clues. You have sort of a main story arc that you're going through, and then little side quests will spin off from the people that are in this town that you're helping out. And by the way, the town is post-flood. Like, there is, you know, when you're going through the archives that exist in this game, there is this bit about everything being before or after the flood. The flood is apparently this horrific event. There's one of his actual books is called Shadows of Innsmouth, and it's about a town that was basically destroyed by one of the Elder Gods in somewhere in New England. So this is like after the fact. It's like the movie The Road. The road doesn't bother to tell you what the fuck happened and why the world is just destroyed. It just sort of is, and now you got to deal with it. So this game sort of takes that same precedent, where it's like, everyone just sort of accepts how fucked up everything is and how awful it is, because they've been through it. They've been through the Great Flood. And these are just the survivors trying to get by in their lives. At any rate, I feel like I'm going off here. But yeah, so you get quests, and they generally tell you how to get to where you're going to do the questy type thing. And uncover mysteries, doing things like, you know, solving murders, finding out who's behind what. There's these big families in the town that kind of run and operate things. You discover that there is this cult potentially worshiping the Elder Gods. You discover that there's all of these.
It's not clear.
What?
Potentially, it's not clear.
Yeah, though they actually seem very New Agey and nice at first.
Okay.
And again, it's sort of up to you. Like, there are these branching paths where you can say, you know, these people are feeding the town folk, and they have this positive outlook, and they're trying to stop people from killing each other. But it also could be that they are, again, trying to convert people to this cult of Cthulhu.
You have to decide if that's a net positive?
Yeah, kind of, exactly. That's the game confronts you with all kinds of decisions like that, where you have to kind of take an allegiance and just deal with the outcome of it. Very, very cool how that works out. The map, fucking love it. Love this map in this game. It's great. For starters, you don't get a mini map. They intentionally do not give you a mini map in the game. So when you're walking around, you're just in the world. If you want to look at a map, you bring up the map. And it's great because when you get a quest, it won't put a pin on a map and tell you where to go. It'll be like, they can be found in this house, and it'll be on Salvation Street between St. Mark's and Fisherman's Road. And then you got to be like, and you have this giant fucking map in front of you, and you're like, wait, where am I going? and you know, it'll tell you kind of the borough that you're going to want to go to. And then you'll kind of just sit there and have to look for the streets and be like, wait a minute, where am I going? And then, it makes you feel like you have a map in your hands, like, how the fuck do I get here? And you can put down little pins to kind of figure out where you want to personally go. But at no point does the game tell you where you need to be or where anything is done. And oftentimes they'll just give you some very abstract references. There are also archives that exist within the police, the medical bays, the university, the library. All of this stuff, by the way, is so very Lovecraftian. He has this way of just like having all of these. It makes sense. And this guy, it feels so video gamey to do it, but it's also so Lovecraftian to do it this way. Where it's like the university is the Miskatonic University is like a big deal. It's where all of these science researchers are coming from that are figuring out that the whole world's been corrupted by Elder Gods, you know? And it's like. I really love the property. I do love Lovecraft's writing a lot. I think he's great, and he has a really unconventional cosmic horror to the way that he writes. It's one thing to make a slasher film or like an evil clown or something, you know, but he has this very psychedelic, weirdly psychedelic, for a guy that, again, if we're not clear, a guy that wrote in like the early 1900s.
Mm.
So my one thing that I would say is, I don't know if I feel like I'm a good detective in this game, or this game just makes me think I'm a good detective. It's the sort of thing where I can't just go to the library and then just gather every article and comb through all the articles and try to find information. It's sort of like I'll go do a mission, and then it'll say, you need to go to the library to find it. And then you'll be given this thing, and it's like, okay, I got to find the three keywords in here that will then get me the piece of paper I need to read to help me navigate to the next part. So I found myself frequently, just because I'm exploring the world, going to places before I can even do the event stuff in it. So I'll just go to this house, and they're like, in the basement there will be this sacrificial altar with all this crazy shit. It's like, isn't this supposed to be just like a nightclub? You know?
And you're like, neat, take a picture and leave.
Right. But then, of course, later on as events unfold, I'll realize I need to go back there. And then when I do, I'll be able to collect some crucial information from there. People will be there that will aid me in moving the story along. So, I mean, to that extent, there's... And I know why they did that, because do you want to really just get 30 news articles and try to figure out why an advertisement about a boat and why, like, this article about an armed robbery that occurred or an award that was given to this doctor for... you know, healing three people and why this new new professor was hired at this university. Why all of this means something, but you don't just get it all at once and then
It's one thing to like be able to like drop you into a world and you can go and like find the basement and like think, okay, there's an altar here, maybe I have to come back later and then leave, and then later on be like, did I need to go to the basement with the goat head altar or the ram's blood altar? But it's an entirely another thing to be able to like hit you with all these walls of text and be like, this is all going to be important text, remember this, you have access to it all right away. I think it's smarter to be like, no, you'll be able to get to the text you need specifically for this quest.
Yeah, you don't want to like have a notebook in the real world and map things out.
Yep.
When you put it like that, Wes, I kind of do.
I mean, you did what... I bet you did when you played, like, Myst and stuff.
Myst, funnily enough, no, I didn't. That game, when you bought it, like, brand new, like, way back in the day, it, like, came with a journal. They gave, like, this little paperback journal. You could write down notes and stuff. And no, I never used it.
Well, no, it was actually human flesh. Weird.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. And that's... Like, the other thing about this game, it is long. It is a very, very long game, and it is very narrative-driven. It's very much about the characters that you interact
with.
It's also not really a game that requires much, like, skill tree and specking and all that stuff. Like, you know, you'll...
Is there a skill tree in specking?
There is a little bit. You will get experience that gives you some sort of passive boost. Things like... you can now carry 6 more revolver rounds. Or, you know, you get maybe a little bit of a health boost. Stuff like that. So there's the... Or, like, you can build more bear traps or, like, foot traps or whatever they call them. So you think little things like that, but they're not going to dramatically change. You're not building a character or class like it's an RPG. You're just getting a bunch of kind of minor things just to sort of keep you invested in wanting to get experience and wanting to invest your skill points. Like... I usually don't invest skill points until I've stacked up 3 or 4. And then I start plugging them into things. It's also very easy to get experience if you do the right quests. So that's very hands-off. And again, keep in mind, you're going to unlock a new weapon maybe every 8 hours of gameplay. I kid you not.
Wow.
This is not a game where you're harvesting resources and stuff like that. You're harvesting resources to keep yourself fucking alive. Again, this is a survival horror game. There is a, you know... You find yourself, unless you're intentionally like scavenging a lot of parts and pieces, you know, and you can't just go to a shop and buy bullets. Like, you literally have to get the gunpowder and then you have to get the shell casings and combine the two, and you can only carry so many. There is a very strict economy to how much damage you can actually do in the game, so it really does keep you in check from just deciding that you're going to go guns akimbo into everything. You really kind of have to be careful, and you're also pretty squishy. You can die very easily if you're not careful, and you have a fucking insanity meter, which is just gnarly, because it's this other thing to balance out. It's just too much weird shit, too much Lovecraftian shit happens to you in the course of the game. That blue bar depletes, and the blue bar is as important as your own health bar, because if that goes to zero, you will essentially, your mind will fracture, you will kill yourself, you know, you will do all kinds of horrible things. So
I love the concept of insanity meters. I'm working on one shot for D&D. I'm implementing an insanity meter because it's a haunted mansion.
Oh, that's very
cool.
So
I just love the concept of insanity meters.
Yeah.
And you're like, well, this is kind of fucked up. I kind of can't handle this anymore. Nice. As my mind shatters.
So I'll leave it there. I'll just say that I personally really, really love this game. If you don't like slow burn detective games, you're not going to like this. If you don't like horror games, you're not going to like this. But if any of that sounds like it's enjoyable, it will certainly resonate with you. And again, it's October. If you wanted a horror game to play in October, it's a really good one to pick up. You'll get lots of hours out of it, as long as, again, you like detective stuff.
I picked it up. I haven't really started it yet. I played about 5 minutes of it, and I realized to me, I was like, yep, this is definitely de-rezzed, because it's a Switch.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that it's... I watched some actual gameplay of someone playing it on a PC version, and it certainly is more crisp. I think, if anything, it's kind of the fact that it's such a muddy game works for it. It doesn't really need to look crisp. Everything's ugly as fuck. And also, because the entire town exists in a fog, draw distance concerns really are not a problem. Okay.
I'm gonna try it on the Switch.
Yeah.
But if I notice some big differences, I'm like, oh, I would like this to be a little crisper. I may still pick it up for the PS4 because it's like $30 when the PS4 is not that bad.
I would say
we'll see how it goes.
Of all things, when the graphics are the most notable, or actually in these conversation trees you have, because there are these very static encounters that you have when you talk to someone where it frames you here, them here, and then the talking goes back and forth with static camera angles, and you see where like other, probably the other high performance consoles would be rendering their faces with a lot more detail.
Yeah, that was the one thing. I did a comparison. I looked up a video about the first conversation you have when you get off the boat. And I thought this was interesting. One, it, like on the regular version of the video I was watching, like you could see their pores and everything like that. It has a lot more details in the face. But like I did a shot of where I was and what the where the video was. It was the exact same shot, and it was cropped in on the Switch version. So they actually even cropped out some of the background and zoomed in a little on it.
Yeah.
I thought that was really interesting that they even bothered doing that, but I guess it was to cut back on. I don't know. I don't know why, but it was just an interesting little thing.
Yeah, I mean, other than that, though, I mean, yeah, I think performance it runs really smooth. I haven't noticed any major
issues. Yeah, I'm gonna try the Switch, see how it goes, and everything. So,
but yeah, so big recommend. I can't. This game is under $10. Like, what a steal!
Very cool. It was $15 on the Switch.
Okay.
Yeah, I grabbed it recently, right before the sale ended.
Okay, nice.
Which I think it's still going on. It's got another day or two, I think.
Mm-hmm. That's all. Cool. That's my video game stuff. All
right, I got three more I'm going to get through really quick.
You see, fucking Barry's the lead here, man. It's got three more games he's got to do.
I had a big marathon session. I finished off a lot of games. I think we didn't... We haven't talked about it in a couple of weeks. I finished off the single player mode in Splatoon 3. It is a pretty robust single player mode. It takes probably like 7 to 8 hours to work through all the whole way through the Splatoon single player, and that's like if you're doing everything. Like it's similar setup to what you would think of like as a Mario single player mode, where you have like different hub areas, and then you enter levels within these like hub areas. And if you are like engaging with everything, you're playing through levels multiple times, like because there are different weapons that are available to you. You can play through these areas multiple times with different weapons. I think something that they did was really smart. So in every zone has its own hub, and in previous Splatoon games, inside each level there would be like little tchotchkes, little collectibles that you could find in each one. Rather than have them actually within the levels, they move them outside into the hub worlds. So if you were like going around in the hub and like spraying the ground and discovering little secrets and stuff, that's how you're finding all of your little collectible shit if you want to go for that sort of thing. And I think it was a really smart thing to move them out of the levels and into the hubs, so that, you know, it gives you something else to do in the hubs and gives you something less to do in the actual level. So they could focus on designing a level for a fun challenge rather than, okay, well, we have a level built. Now we got to find like places to tuck these behind a corner or something. The single player itself, I don't think makes you a better Splatoon player if you're going like for the main event, like for all the online stuff. I do think it like gives you a nice opportunity to try out different weapons that normally you maybe wouldn't try. Like maybe you don't think you'd be going with a sniper gun, but you just come across a sniper gun in the single player mode that turns out to be pretty cool. Maybe you want to try it in an actual competitive mode. But they do like a lot of things like platforming challenges or like on rails levels, like things that, you know, they're able to use like Splatoon mechanics of like spraying the ground and swimming around in it, or using like spraying the wall and being able to swim up walls, like mechanics that they can explore more in depth that they wouldn't do in like an online competitive arena battle. So it's a nice opportunity to see what they do with those sort of mechanics that you wouldn't see in those other modes. But yeah, I thought it was a really good single player mode. There are a few boss battles, nothing really too tough, just kind of like find the weak point and hit them three times and then go to the next mode and hit them three times again, kind of like Mario style stuff. And I played a bit of Salmon Run with our friend Jake from the Discord group. We played a few rounds of that a couple of times. Yeah, my favorite mode for sure. I really love Salmon Run. They mix up a couple different things this time around. So if you're unfamiliar, Salmon Run is a mode in Splatoon where rather than playing competitively, you have a squad of four and you're playing cooperatively against like CPU. But rather than it being like claim the most territory to win, the CPU will have like these big bosses that they'll enter with. And there'll be like a big tower of kettles and you got to like take them all down, or it'll be like a big angry fish with baskets on each of its shoulders. You got to throw a bomb in each of the baskets. And when you defeat one of these things, they drop like these golden eggs, and you have to take those and run them back to your base. And you have a time limit. You have to collect X amount and then get them back to your base before the mode ends, and you get to like go to the next phase. And when you get to the final phase, you beat the final boss and you win. And they do a couple of things to mix it up this time. Every once in a while, every, I don't know, maybe 20% of the rounds that you play through, in the final round, the final boss will be like this big kaiju monster that you have to take down. And the only, the main way to do it is to find like the big like howitzer gun somewhere in the battlefield in order to take him down. Because if you're all just kind of spraying with the weapons that you have on hand, you're probably not going to be able to do damage fast enough. Yeah, really cool mode. Really like it. Splatoon 3, I know, I'd probably still play it more if there weren't so many other games coming out. One of those games is Diofield Chronicle. That's the Square Enix RTS that we talked about on the official show. I finished that one off. I don't really have too many things to expand on because the game doesn't really expand on itself. It's kind of the same. That's what you want. Yeah, for... And I was only like, I would set aside like an hour a day. I'm like, okay, I'm going to play an hour a day. I'll probably work my way through three or four missions. There's a ton of side missions. And there's also like a lot of like skill trees and upgrade trees that you can go through to upgrade like your classes and stuff. We talked about the classes on the official show, all the different like archers and mounted units that you can be. And every character is kind of locked into their class. And when you upgrade, how a mounted unit behaves is going to improve all of your mounted units. It's kind of like a Valkyria Chronicles in that way. But there's also like your summons that you can improve, and you can improve like your weapons tech trees, so you can buy different weapons and accessories and improve your characters that way. They're expensive in the beginning, but of course the more you play through the game, the more money rewards you get from your missions, and you're able to like buy materials that will help you upgrade, and money becomes less of an issue the further you get into it. So... as I was saying on the official show, the tactics don't really particularly change. Every mission, just about, it's like 95% of the missions, the tactic with any sort of engagement, I was like, okay, I got my tanky character, I got my range character, and I got my assassin character. He's doing my DPS. Send the tank in first, draw all the aggro, and have the other units come up and do the rear attacks, because that's how you're doing the most damage. And as long as your tank is drawing all the aggro, you're going to be able to do damage quickly. And as soon as they get to like 50% health, have your assassin execute his assassinate move, which is almost always an instant kill, and then you move on to the next opponent. Thankfully, there is a speed-up mode, which is how... but probably the reason I got through the entire game is because most battles I could just like set it to max speed, or at least like 1.5 times speed, and churn through these things more quickly. And I think by the time, like there are seven chapters. When I got to chapter seven, I had so much momentum going forward. I was like, okay, I'm just going to sit down and beat this. And I had like a 2-hour play session and finished off the final chapter, and that was the end of it. I don't know. I think that if I were to draw conclusions, totally unfounded conclusions, I would say that somebody had like a basic idea for what an RTS could be on the Switch, or with these also RPG mechanics, and they just got greenlit at Square Enix, and they never had like a producer or someone come in and say, okay, well, what else are you doing with this game? They just kind of made... they made a game based on one idea and never tried to do different things with it. And I think like there are really basic things that they could have done in order to make the game a lot more interesting, such as have more than a maximum of four characters in a battle. So I think I talked about this on the official show. You have a maximum of four characters, and they each kind of get like a bench character. So you can have eight possible characters in a particular fight, but only four are active at one time. You can swap between, but you only get like three, a maximum of three, like bench swaps in a battle. So you need to be judicious about when you do it. And if I'm being completely frank, I never did it. So
you basically just ran the game with Ondarius Rondarison.
Yes.
And Iscarion Colchester.
Yes.
And Frederick Lester.
Yes.
What about Walter Quinn Redditch?
Walter Quinn. Okay, so I was not paying attention to the story at all, but Walter Quinn takes a heel turn. I'm not sure why, but she becomes a villain.
Interesting.
Yeah, yeah.
But she's still in your party, or?
No, at that point she's no longer in the party. There is another point in the game where like your party splits up and there's like one or two missions where you can only select from a certain pool of characters, and another couple of missions, one or two missions where you can only select from a pool of the opposite characters who are not available in each other's scenarios. And that
they may tell you that you can only play with Elizair Wigan and Rickenbach Medea and Donna Varsalion. Shivat Malzin.
Oh my
god. They don't synergize well.
That person has like Medusa hair. Like the hairs are just everywhere.
Screaming infidelity. But they spent like so much time and effort with these tremendous names, just like top notch.
By the way, one of them is just named Catherine. One of them is just named Catherine.
Yeah,
she's a maid or something too.
Fucking Kathy. No, she's a tank character.
Yeah,
and usually your tanks are like have a sword and shield, is the sort of weapon class that they use. But like there are like things that you can do like to mix and match your active skills. Like some active skills will do things like draw aggro, other ones will do like more damage from a particular position. There are status ammos, even like stun or burn or like poison, and like there are certain moves that will do more damage if an enemy is afflicted with status units. Eventually, like, you will get passive skills where, you know, your archer will do more damage to mounted units, that sort of thing. It all feels very slight. Like, none of it's all that important, because like just use the main tactic of drawing aggro and attacking from behind and you'll be totally fine. And I think like if they had just expanded the scope a little bit, so you have more than four active units in a fight and maybe have to manage like different sides of a battlefield at the same time, might have made for some more interesting fights. But it's pretty much like, okay, take my group, go fight that first wave. They're done, okay, take the group, go fight a different wave. Sometimes there's exploding barrels, because of course there are. I think, on the whole, pretty unremarkable game. I think that there's a free demo if you play through it and you really like what you see in Chapter 1, because all of Chapter 1 is playable, then hang out for a sale, because guaranteed this game will be on sale for like $10 at some point.
Cool.
The last game that I got is Nier Automata. I finished the first playthrough today. This is a game where it's sort of intended that you play through it three times, because you're playing through as different characters and get different perspectives. I don't know that I ever talked about this one when I played through it on PS4. I did?
On some mini show, yeah.
Okay. I don't know. I think I was kind of lukewarm on it when I talked about it on PS4, and I think I'm still kind of lukewarm. I think it's fine. I don't think it's like... Some people like are really into this game. Like it's some sort of revelation. I think as a hack and slash action game, it's totally competent. Like, this is a good game. It's got I don't know, some things like people would consider RPG elements, but it's just kind of like what video games do now, where you level up and you can buy different weapons and upgrade them, and you have like passive and active skills that you could upgrade on your own character. So I don't know if I'd go as far as to call this an action RPG. It's an action game. It is, you know, at least presentationally set in an open world. There are a lot of big spaces that you can run through. There's not a whole lot of interaction that happens outside of, like, a scattered fight here and there. We're not talking, like, this is very weird playing this game after Breath of the Wild, because Breath of the Wild, like, interacting with the environment was the game. That's what you were engaging with most of the time. And then... anytime I come across like an open world at this point, I'm like, okay, what can I do? Can I climb this? Can I go around this? Can I go through that open passageway in this dilapidated building? Nope, can't do any of that. There are times in Nier Automata where there's a broken down building with a big open doorway that leads inside. Like, okay, let's go in there, see what's there. And there's an invisible wall. You just can't go there. So it's weird, like, having that sort of limitation. But like the game isn't trying to be a big exploration game. It is an action game, and I think like it does a good job of having like this fluid action with a lot of different types of play styles. You got different types of weapons. You got like swords and spears and like big like heavy claymores and stuff, heavy swords. So a lot of different things you can mess around with, different types of ranged weapons as well. And I think the thing that I think is most remarkable about the game is how it is able to just sort of switch genres kind of into like related genres. So when you start out, it's kind of like a behind the back 3D action game. There are points where it just kind of seamlessly transitions into a side scrolling action game. And you're kind of like on a static path going forward and backward as opposed to moving in three dimensional space. And then it will like very smoothly take you back out of that. Then there are parts where it transitions to like a top down action game, which feels a little bit akin to a twin stick shooter. And then the points of the game where it becomes a twin stick shooter. And then it'll transition from a twin stick shooter into like just a scrolling shooter, like a Gladius or an R-Type. It's really interesting the way that it's able to smoothly go from between all these different play styles. And it never feels out of place. It always feels like, okay, logically, yeah, this is the next thing you're going to be doing.
So it's like the WarioWare of a hack and slash?
Yeah, maybe.
Kind of,
yeah. There's been a lot of praise about this particular Switch port because of how competently that Square Enix has been able to get this game running on Switch. And I think a lot of that praise is founded. It is impressive that they got this all running on Switch. It runs very smoothly. The frame rate is pretty steady. I don't know that I can say that I've encountered any significant frame rate dips. There are points in the game where it takes a couple of seconds for textures to load in, specifically on like things that are like large structures in the distance. There are times where I'm like running through an area and I'll quickly like turn around and run in the other direction, and the game's like, oh wait, no, I don't. Okay, okay, now the texture's there. Now you're good. So you know, not like a perfect port, but still like a pretty impressive job that they got this thing going. I did finish off, like I said, the first playthrough. I got ending A. There's actually 26 endings.
God.
But like three of them are like the main ones, and the other ones are kind of like joke endings. You have to do like weird or unexpected things, and the game will just give you credits like, yeah, you found an ending. So it's not like you're playing through the game 26 times in order to find all these. A lot of times it's like, okay, well, you're in this playthrough, you did this thing, that'll get you an ending, then you just pick up where you left off. The first playthrough, you're playing as the character 2B, which is probably what you're seeing in all the fan art. And it's with a few exceptions, it's probably like 70% like action hack and slash. And then I earlier today immediately started up a second run through where you're playing as her partner character 9S. And so far I played like two and a half hours of that run through, and it has been a good 80% like twin stick shooter or like scrolling shooter. So it's significantly different in the play style. It's also got some differences because there are points in the game where the two of them will separate and you'll play through like different story segments. So you're going to get like a different perspective on a narrative that's happening when you're playing as a different character. I have my suspicions about who the third playthrough will be as, but I'm not entirely sure how that will play out. We'll see. The other thing about playing as 9S is that when you're playing as 2B, it's very much like a Bayonetta or a Devil May Cry, where you have your light attack and your heavy attack, and how you're putting them together is going to affect that the way that you are damaging and like how acrobatic you look doing these things. A 9S does not have a heavy attack. He's got a light attack, and then he's got like a ranged attack. But it doesn't do damage. Rather, it builds up this meter where you're like hacking into an enemy unit and an enemy character that you're fighting against. And sometimes you're fighting against a significant amount of enemies that can flood the screen quite a bit. But when you fill up this meter, you transition immediately into like this very like simple polygon looking twin stick shooter mode. And when you achieve the it only takes a couple of seconds. When you achieve the objective, and when you destroy like the little orb inside this twin stick shooter in this little arena that you put it, that they put you in, it zooms back out. You go back to like the main action, and that enemy that you hacked self destructs, and it's an instant kill. It's pretty cool. On some enemies, it's an instant kill. On bosses, you're not, of course, instant killing those. But it's interesting that, you know, all of like the acrobatic things you were doing as 2B and stringing together these combos, like that's not even available with 9S. You're, most of the time when I'm getting into big fights, I'm doing a couple little quick hits with a sword and then hacking into an enemy and doing these quick little shooters. It's a really interesting game. It's a budget price too, $39.99.
Yeah.
You have to not release that the AAA price. Mm-hmm. I think it's well worth a try. And, you know, whether you played on Switch or different platforms, kind of like depends on your platform of choice. I think it runs well enough on Switch to be comparable to, like, if you're buying it on PS4. If you're buying it on PS4, it might be significantly cheaper. I like having it on Switch because I'm able to bring it to work with me and play through a little bit, like, on a lunch break. I like having that portability.
Yeah. Yeah, see, it came out. It's been out for a bit, right?
Oh, yeah, 2017 it came out.
And I guess, I think you talked about this last time. It kind of came out in the shadow of Breath of the Wild.
Yeah.
So it kind of gets a little overshadowed. It still says here that it sold close to 7 million copies.
Oh, good for
worldwide.
Them.
Worldwide. So, I mean, that's very good sales.
Yeah, that's significant. So
this game certainly got around.
Mm-hmm. For sure. Well, that's all I got for games. You guys got anything else you want to talk about? Open the floor?
Was this the one we're going to add more to the tier list?
Oh, shit. Yeah, you're right. We do have tiers.
I looked at it. I didn't do it.
Okay, I got a couple.
You can't give me homework, John. You know I'm not going to do it. I was a terrible student.
So, just to review, we settled on our S tier. And, of course, like, these are ones that are definitely in the S tier. There are other things that may end up in the S tier. We'll see.
Yeah.
But it was Mario platformers, Legend of Zelda, Mario Kart, Smash, and Pokemon. Those are our five definite S tiers.
You, no way you can argue any of those can be anything other than S rankings. Yeah.
And then we talked on the last mini show, we talked about Fire Emblem and Xenoblade, put them both in the B tier, and then Advance Wars went into the C tier.
Sounds about right.
And what we're trying to eventually end up with is like a pyramid shape. Like there might not be very many in the F tier. We'll see. There will be some. But like, we don't want to have more in the S tier than we have in the A tier. And we don't want to have more in the A tier than we have in the B tier. There's kind of like, you have to see things rising to the top rather than, like, everything is amazing, everything goes in the A tier.
What a time to be alive.
Indeed. And, you know, as we talk about more of these, like, and things kind of fall into place, we might realize, oh, we got some room over here. Maybe we shift something around. We'll see.
We should reorganize or maybe drop a couple of them down a little further than what we currently have. Totally understandable.
Know, I think we might raise some of them up a little bit.
This is good. This is great. Can I tell you, I might have gone a little deep on this.
Oh, please, yes. Which one do you want to start with?
Because we can't, well, here's the thing. We can't just say, is it a this or is it a this? So I actually broke it down into four categories.
Okay.
Critical components that I think help you assign an actual grade to something.
I have some components as well. What are yours?
I kind of put them in what I think are the order of importance as well. Longevity.
Okay.
I think the length of time a series has been around means it's had the chance to interact with more people. It's more important. I believe I pinned it at 1981 is when the first like Nintendo video game comes out.
Hmm.
So that's a very, very, very long time. That's 40 years.
What was the first Nintendo video game?
I don't... Well, we're going to talk about it a little later, in fact.
Crazy Taxi.
Yeah. No, actually, I don't know if it was the very first game. But we'll talk about one in a bit. But I think longevity, number one. I know it's been up for debate. Number two, I have sales. I think if you do sell games, you should be rewarded. And if you don't sell games, you can't reward that. Three, I have reception, which is just sort of critics mostly for the older games to talk about, but then also fan reception is important. And lastly, I kind of have this catch-all category that I have termed iconography, which includes things like brand, marketability, reach. Like, if you took someone that could only name five video game characters, is this going to be a character that they would name that they would know? I think of a character like, of all characters, even though I wouldn't say that the Tomb Raider series is amazing, Lara Croft is probably one of the most recognizable video game characters. Mm. You know, the same with obviously Mario. Even Zelda, like, Link isn't really that recognizable of a character. It's even a joke that people confuse that Zelda isn't Link.
Right.
So, like,
right.
If we were doing an individual ranking, I don't know that Link is necessarily gets an S in terms of his marketability or brand.
Mm.
You know? Anyway, that's beside this point. Those are my categories, right? Longevity, sales, reception, and brand. And then you add all those up, and then you probably can get a good sense of what you should grade a thing at. So, I was given two to do. I chose mine at random just because I had never even heard of these series.
Okay.
So
yeah,
I'm just like, boom and boom.
Why don't we open up with one of yours?
All right. So, here's an example. Pushmo.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Pushmo.
I've played these games.
Have you heard of it?
I've heard of it. I couldn't tell you.
Okay.
If you put a cover art but took out Pushmo, I wouldn't be able to tell you.
I own these games.
You play? Okay, so let's get into it then. So it's made by Intelligent Systems,
mm-hmm.
a company that's responsible for Advance Wars, WarioWare, Fire Emblem.
Paper Mario.
Yeah, big time company within the world of Nintendo, right? Their first installment of the game Pushmo was on the 3DS in 2011. There's a sequel, Crashmo, a third game called Pushmo World, and a final game called Stretchmo, which came out in 2015, and that one was on the Wii U. So, as I understand, this franchise existed for about 4 years.
Yep.
Three of the games on the DS and one on the Wii U. The general concept of the game Pushmo is it's a puzzle game. It's essentially a puzzle game about building a ladder to get to the top of a tower to get a thing. And then at the top is like a prize, or you're fraying something.
There's a flag at the top. And like a lot of times, like it'll start you with something simple, like pull these blocks around in order to like make a staircase. And really all you're doing in every level is trying to find your staircase. What is going to be the proper order of pulling things out toward the screen. It was pushing things like back into the screen, like and arranging things in order to create your path up to the top.
Oh, and they're like pixel art. So mm-hmm. It'll be like a big drawing of a thing, but then you have to sort of like move the pieces around so that you can navigate. Because it's sort of like a three-dimensional puzzle.
Right.
Because there's rows.
And I have to speculate that a lot of the sort of inspiration for this game came from trying to use that 3D effect on the 3DS. Because rather than sort of sliding things around like side to side, you are pulling things toward the screen or pushing things back away from the screen. So,
yeah.
You using that stereoscopic 3D.
So, this game, Critical Darling,
mm-hmm.
got great reviews. Every game that they made in this got either a high 8 or a low F. low 9. So, it got really good reviews, generally.
Crazy. Have you spilled the beans on your tier placing?
well, let's get to the sales data. So sales data is hard to find, but they have never sold more than 1 million copies of any one of their games.
Yeah, this is downloadable only on the 3DS eShop. And don't get me wrong, like I really liked the 3DS eShop. There's a lot of cool little games. I think like those old like 3DS or WiiWare eShop games, like there really wasn't and there isn't anymore a space for like really small bite-sized games. Like even mobile games now kind of have like their own little niche, and they've expanded the scope. Like small scope games, there isn't like an exclusive place for them that can exist anymore. Even like the Switch eShop, there's games like Tunic and Neon White. Like these are games that aren't really small scope anymore.
Yeah. So the main character of it, you know the main character by name?
I don't.
His name's Mallow.
Oh, right.
Sorry, did you know?
I was going to guess Push.
No, sadly it is not Shove. Push. Yeah, it's a Mallow, and no one's ever heard of it. Oh. Okay, so the last thing here is that... So here's the last appearance of not even Mallow, but Pushmo itself...
3DS?
...came in 2018, where the concept of the game was used as a... was used in WarioWare Gold as a minigame. And that game itself likely didn't even sell 100,000 units. So if your entire brand has been condensed to a mini game, a micro game inside of WarioWare that doesn't even sell 100,000 units, that's where you're at.
Got it. A tier.
So longevity gets an F. It exists for 4 years, essentially. Sales gets an F. The entire franchise likely didn't even sell 2 million units. Reception, A. Gets an A. Critics love this game. This game is supposedly great. No one ever played it, though. And iconography, because no one even knows a character from this, it gets an F. So it means it's a mid-F in my mind. Mm. This is a forgettable series that, you know, John, you played it and you liked it for sure, and you probably recommend it to people that want a puzzler for their 3DS, but unless you already installed it, you're probably in trouble.
And there are a lot of games where I would hesitate putting into an F tier, because to me, like, putting something in an F tier means like this is a failed franchise, it's not coming back. I don't think Pushmo's coming back. I'm totally comfortable with an F tier here.
Cool.
I like these games. I think I bought the first one, and I definitely finished the first one. And I think, like, the second and third one, I got on deep discount from, like, a Club Nintendo reward back when that was a thing. Mm-hmm. I don't think I ever finished either of the sequels.
Crushmo and Pushmo World.
And I never...
One of those.
I never played Stretchmo on Wii U.
Okay.
So, yeah.
So, yeah. You said that you were going to do DK and Pikmin. So, do you want me to do my two and then you do your two?
No, let's move to DK. Let's do DK.
All right. You want to like leave? DK.
Donkey Kong. Is this the one from 1981 that you were talking about?
Yes. Debuted in 1981.
As the villain, but was the title character of the game?
The first Mario game is called Donkey Kong.
Yep. And he's called Jumpman.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think, like, in terms of iconography, like, he might be the...
Mount Rushmore, for sure.
Second most recognizable Nintendo character.
Yeah, for sure.
And stuck around so long. And even though, like, the character has gone through a lot of, like, iterations, like, the DK and, like, DK Country is not, like, the Donkey Kong character in the Donkey Kong games. It's a different character. Neither here nor there. But, you know, goes through, like, all of these platform shifts, some successfully, some not so much, goes from being a villain in, like, arcades. Then you get, like, 2D platformers with the Donkey Kong Country games. It was a huge revival for that character. You get a transition to 3D that maybe wasn't so great. That was kind of like the dark period for Donkey Kong with games like Donkey Kong 64 or even something like a Jungle Beat. Jungle Beat was pretty well received, if memory serves, but is not a game that is hugely recognizable on its own, or probably it's a game that carries more clout within the fan community. Let's put it that way. Mm-hmm. But then you got, like, this big revival with Donkey Kong Returns, Tropical Freeze, games, Critical Darlings, and do okay in terms of sales. Like, they sell a couple million.
6 million, a huge success. It sold 6 million units of Tropical Freeze.
Returns in Tropical Freeze, is that combined Wii U and Switch? No. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's great. That's great. Mm-hmm. That is great sales numbers. We've got franchises currently in the B tier that have not sold that many units. Mm. This is a weird thing I think about it. Of all things, this is kind of like The Simpsons. Simpsons are inarguably, like, the greatest American television comedy ever made, regardless of whether or not it's animated.
Hmm.
It's been around for 30 years, and most people say the last 20 years kind of weren't that great. Like, that's unreal that you even had a show for 20 years. Yeah, but that's not the golden age.
It's a show that's been failing for 20 years, but it still can't seem to die. Like that means probably doing something right.
Tropical Freeze sort of brings back this kind of dormant franchise. And keep in mind, Donkey Kong, still huge. Donkey Kong is in millions of sales, he's in the Mario Kart games.
He's in the sports games. He gets, like, there's the Donkey Mario versus Donkey Kong sort of smaller games that are mostly on handheld systems. He gets like King of Swing. Mm-hmm. Like, he's a character that they experimented with until Donkey Kong Country Returns on Wii, where they finally sort of made this return back to 2D platforming.
Yeah. I think he functions best as a platformer for sure. Yeah. He's the original platformer. Mario was not the first platformer that Nintendo made. It was Donkey Kong.
And it's such a different feel of a platformer. Like the character, like, feels heavier. It's got weight to him. It's got more impact when he lands on the ground. They definitely have this is how Mario feels. This is how Donkey Kong is supposed to feel. And it's a character where they're not tenuous about offering something that's more of a platforming challenge. Like the Donkey Kong Country Returns games are more difficult than your typical Mario games.
What do you think is the deal with the tie, though? Do you think he has, like, a day job, like an office job?
I think he's trying to be
presentable.
Do you
think he's a lawyer? Yeah. Just, you know.
He's just a traditionalist. You know, he thinks that, you know, if you're going to take a flight, you put a suit on. You know, he's that kind of guy. And then he probably looks at his ups, you know, his little nephew or whatever, Diddy Kong, who's just wearing, like, a band shirt and a backwards baseball cap, and is like, kid.
Or, like, Funky Kong.
Right, no, that wasteoid.
Yeah. And there was a time for this series where you had like this expanding roster of characters, Funky Kong and Cranky Kong and Candy Kong, Dixie Kong and Kitty Kong, and all these fuckers. Yeah. All these animal buddies.
Different, some of them different species of primates too, mm-hmm. and yet we're all to believe that they are related.
Mm. It does invent the special tie that also is a name tag. I think that's brilliant right there.
That's a good point.
Yeah.
Just, a good point.
Name tag slash tie. So you look presentable, and yet people do know your name.
Well, I think it's important. You're kind of joking here, but also at the same time, you just perfectly described what Donkey Kong looks like. You know in your mind what... it is an icon. You can vision what DK looks like. The dude.
Monkey with the tie. Yeah. That has his name on it.
Oh, it's an ape? I'm sorry.
In the same way that, we're all monkeys, right?
In the same way that penguins are fish.
Yes, exactly.
So you want to go point by point with this one?
A couple other things I would bring up.
Yeah.
It's responsible, especially in the early generations of the Famicom, NES, SNES. It had some of the best selling titles. It had some of the best reviewed titles. I think that, sure, probably Super Mario World maybe sold more copies than Donkey Kong Country, but I think people look back at Donkey Kong Country and say that's a work of art. Absolutely beautiful game. It sold over 80 million copies as a franchise across 22 titles. A lot of these titles were, again, they had three different SNES Donkey Kong games that sold over 5 million copies. Unreal. There's that, I don't even know how true it is, but there's that old saying that, like, Nintendo, if they didn't make another dollar, they could go on for 10 years.
No, it's like 80 years.
80 years and not deplete the reserves. This series is the kingdom. This is what built that castle, right? Like, these sales early on are why the N64 can be a bomb as a console, and they're still good, right? Donkey Kong made this franchise, made Nintendo so much money over time. But yeah, and if you want to go, let's just do it. Let's go letter by letter, then longevity. What do you think? It's the fucking first game.
S tier.
S, guaranteed S. Sales, 80 million units sold. That's huge. I would.
That's a good solid B.
Yeah.
I think I would hesitate to say S in terms of sales, just because I would be interested to compare that to something like a Smash Brothers or a Mario Kart.
Pokemon.
Like, yeah. these are ones where, like, Mario Kart, like Mario Kart 8 has probably sold nearly 80 million units.
Yeah, I think especially when you look through certain consoles, like the NES and the SNES were huge for Donkey Kong. And yeah, and aside from
Breath of the Wild is getting close to 25 million units. That's a game.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, I mean, that is huge, but this caught for, let's call it a 15 years for Nintendo. This was their franchise. Obviously Mario, but then DK immediately after it. Like, 80 million units is unreal. That is big numbers to be pushing. And we're going to get through a lot of these other franchises on this list that don't get even close to 10 million.
Well, let's put a pin in that one, see where we're at with the rest of them. The other
reception
two.
I think it's a little all over the place, but there are some games, again, that had people legitimately questioning whether gaming is art. Some of the best music, some of the best animation.
Yeah, that one song.
Oh, like Aquatic Ambience. Everyone loves Aquatic Ambience.
Yeah, everybody loves
that
song.
The Bramble, Bramble Bash, I think it's called.
I personally give it an A.
Yeah, I would agree.
Yeah, I mean, sure, there's like the bongo game. I don't even know if people like it. The bongo game sounds like it's more of a meme than anything, and people seem to genuinely like the bongo game. It was just kind of a weird one. And iconography and reach. Yeah, it's one
S-tier.
Of the most recognizable video game characters ever.
So it seems like we're trying to decide if DK is in the A tier or the S tier.
I have it listed as a low S.
Wes, what do you think?
I'm fine with the S.
Put him in the S. There
low
we go.
S. And again, hey, we can move these things around if it's...
Yeah.
No, this is in stone. I have my chisel here.
Yeah.
I'm doing this now.
All right, so do you want to go over to... I still have Brain Age to cover, and you did Pikmin as well.
Let's do Brain Age.
Brain Age. Again, I had never fucking heard of this series.
It's a DS game. It's two DS games. And then I think there are some downloadable ones on DSi or something.
Yeah, so it's developed by Nintendo Software Planning and Developed, NSPD, which is just in-house game development for mm-hmm. Nintendo. It has a couple of different names depending upon where you're looking, and what time frame you're in. It goes under some other moniker later on. But yeah, it's a lot of in-house tech stuff that they're doing. So first installment came out in 2005 on the 3DS. They made three
original DS.
Yeah, the original DS, and then they made three sequels on the DS and a Switch title in 2019. I don't know if you guys are aware that this...
What's the name of the Switch title?
Oh, even fucking knows.
It is like Brain Age something. I'm going to take a straight guess. I'm going to guess that this is a C-tier game.
So...
No knowledge at all. I'm just going to straight up guess.
Are we combining Brain Age with Big Brain Academy?
No.
Okay.
Oh, that's what I'm thinking of. I'm thinking of Big Brain Academy.
Okay. I did a brief skim through Big Brain Academy and was severely unimpressed as well. I don't know, like, they're not related to each other. It'll be its own thing, I guess we'll talk about. But
right.
So is there a Brain Age on the Switch?
Yes.
Oh, man, I had not heard of that.
Well, good job, John.
I know, right?
So what is Brain Age? It's an educational mini-games. Think of it as like a cerebral take on WarioWare. They're designed to improve logistics and computational skills. If you would watch it, it'd be like, how quickly can you perform some multiplications? How is your pattern recognition with numbers and letters? And you kind of just draw on the DS the answers. Mm-hmm. So it's not like you're picking A, B, C, D.
Or speaking into the microphone.
Yeah, yeah.
Just screaming into the abyss.
So it got, on average, pretty poor reviews. It got 7 out of 10 reviews. But here's the thing. I don't even think reviews matter for this game at all, because it's not what it's about.
Yeah, you might as well be like reviewing a Sudoku book.
Perfect. Yeah, it's
I'm gonna review the SATs.
nobody looks at a crossword puzzle and says, like, is this artistic? They're like, is it neatly written in like the most simple Helvetica font, and are the clues make sense?
And if that person exists, go ahead and never be friends with them.
Right? There's no recognizable characters. There's no logo. There's really nothing to this in terms of iconography. There's really not a lot to latch onto. There's like some doctor behind it who apparently sells it.
Yeah, some quack.
This sounds more and more like a D tier now.
he's this guy. Well, I think the thing about this game is that first Brain Age game sold gangbusters. It was huge.
No, no. Fucking monstrous sales. Two of the top 10 best-selling DS games are fucking Brain Age games.
Yep.
They sold over 33 million units on the DS.
Damn.
Keep in mind, there's about 150 million DSs were sold. So if you just do the math, 20% of DSs probably churned a Brain Age game at some point. Considering Pushmo can't even sell a fucking couple million units.
Mm.
Like,
this was like,
whoa. Yeah, you got to take another swing at Pushmo, don't you? You just
this was like the big like touch generation sort of a line of games that Nintendo was pushing, like when they were really making a big push into the casual crowd back before smartphones became like a big part of people's lives. This was the casual game. Like somebody would buy a DS for like a parent or something, and like, okay, and here's Brain Age.
Yeah, and it kind of, you can do this under the guise that you're juicing their mind.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is one of those things that's like, they always recommend you, like, wake up. The second your head pops off the pillow, do some math or something. Or do something that activates your brain and starts making you think. And that it's supposed to help you get into the day. And that's precisely what Brain Age could do. You could sit there for 5 to 10 minutes and just do some puzzles.
It's like a Duolingo. Just, you gotta go knock out your lessons for the day.
Yeah. So, again, we cannot... like overlook that they sold 33 fucking million units. That's crazy. And this was not like a $9.99 game or something. They sold this thing, if I remember correctly, for like
$39.99 actually.
Oh, okay.
Like, this one was a budget price game, but you know, it's not like a free to play mobile game. Like, you still had to actually go into a store and buy a box copy of this thing. Couldn't just download it.
And I remember, like, when I first saw the logo, I was like, oh, this is that game that, like, every secondhand video game store sells for $5.
Mm-hmm.
It is a cheap cartridge. These things are not
They're rare everywhere.
Because they sold 33 million units. So, if you want to get to the lettering of it, I give it a C. And by the way, the one in 2019 that's for the Switch, it did sell a million units. It sold at least a million units. So, there is still some people that see the brand and are like, I'll buy in. So in terms of its longevity, I give it a C because it was around in 2005. It was a fucking huge deal back in 2005, or back in the you know, when these games were coming out, they were huge hits on the DS. And then it's still relevant today. It does have a new version of itself floating around on the Switch, so I give it a C. I don't know, what do you guys think?
Yeah, I could see a C or maybe like a high D because it has fallen off so significantly, go from selling like 33 million units to like breaking a million. So
yeah,
you do see a significant drop off there. But we can call it a C or possibly a D for now and see how the rest of them play out.
Sales, S. Mm-hmm. This company out of nowhere sold close to 40 million units combined as a franchise. That's unbelievable. 40 million units, you can't. Again, we've set the standard that a franchise can sell 6 million units and be in the B tier. So let's keep that in mind. You gotta reward it for the sales. A reception, I mean, I could give it a... You give whatever you want. You give it a C or a D, honestly. Like, it reviewed very poorly, but...
I don't know, like, 7s out of 10. It was fine. I'd give it a C.
Yeah. And iconography, there's nothing recognizable about this. Even the logo is boring. The logo is in Times New Roman. You know, it just says Brain Age. It's
default.
And it's this picture of a brain, and it's so fucking boring.
It's looking. Just like a clip art picture of a brain.
It really does. It looks so low effort. Overall, I'm giving this thing a low B. Honestly, this is incredible that a game was this successful. And I bet you, and I know you're thinking this doesn't deserve a low B. I bet you this will be the lowest rated on our tier list that sold at least 30 million units.
I'd probably agree with you there.
You're kind of dragging up to B just based on sales. I mean, everything else was low on that, but you say because sales are so high, it deserves to be a low B. Like I'm thinking C, and that's.
I'm leaning towards C as well, mostly because like yes, it sold a lot, but it's very front loaded. This is a series that has taken a significant turn, more obscure, rather than being like the hot software on a DS.
And keep in mind, this is a product coming out of Nintendo software planning and development.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. You realize how fucking little they spent on this? This isn't Konami being like, we get our cut here, guys. This is them pocketing $600 million.
Mm.
Again,
made back.
Nintendo will live for 80 years on the backs of fucking Brain Age. Like, for what it means to the company, I just don't think you can look 30 million units in the face and say,
But is Xenoblade that much better though? Yeah, it is. And here's why.
Yeah.
So you bring up like we have other things in the B tier, Fire Emblem, Xenoblade, and I think that those belong in the B tier, a tier above Brain Age, because these are things that Nintendo is actually doing franchise care. They're actually doing regular releases. They do expanded content. They really push these games. A Brain Age came out on Switch. We do a Nintendo podcast. I had no idea.
Yeah, we just now found out that there was one on the Switch. I thought you guys Brain Academy was the Brain Age.
It sold over a million copies, though.
Okay.
Like, it's not like it doesn't have people buying it. It's out there, and it does have some sales. It's not nothing. But I agree.
Yeah,
like,
but you're letting the past carry it hard.
I am, for sure. Because if you sell 30 million units, there's a feather in your fucking cap, man. That's two feathers in the cap.
You're so obsessed with money. The fucking account here is obsessed with money.
Nintendo doesn't make money. They don't make video games. I think that you guys maybe don't like this idea that, you know, some of these franchises that we love so much that don't sell particularly well get propped up by other franchises that are not art, that are not the art that we appreciate in the games that we love. I still stand by a low B, and I'd be willing to fluctuate. If you guys want to put it high C, I think that's a high C, but there's no way that, like, we could say this is equal to Advance Wars. Like, this game is more significant than Advance Wars. Just because sheer volume of units pushed, money in the bank to fund future failures for Nintendo. That's my case.
Okay, let's go. I don't like it. Let's put it in a high C above Advance Wars. However, let's put that contingent on how well the Advance Wars reboot does. If Advance Wars reboot camp can manage to outsell Brain Age on Switch.
I thought I was going to slam dunk you guys for telling you that, like, for every copy of Xenoblade ever sold as a franchise, there was 5 units of Brain Age pushed.
So, and again, I think that's significant.
1999, back at the.
It's so much easier
just to drop that.
It is on the DS. It's a much more casual friendly piece of software. Not a game that we would consider it a game, but I think it is significant that the most recent Xenoblade, all three of the most recent Xenoblades outsell the most recent Brain Age. There is a recency bias that I'm suggesting here. And I think it's significant that Nintendo is like, yeah, keep pumping out Xenoblades. It was like, okay, a Brain Age.
Well, and I should also bring up, like, it's not on the list. It's not a franchise, so we can talk about it. You know the second best-selling DS game of all time? It's a one-off. Nintendogs.
We should put Nintendogs on the list because there is a Nintendogs on 3DS. There is a sequel.
Don't you know anything more than to tell you that it's a low B?
Based on sales alone,
it's a low B. You're either Nintendogs B+.
Nintendogs was pretty fucking huge.
No, I'm just kidding. But no, I think that this is a really interesting market that, if anything, I don't know why Nintendo doesn't try to capitalize on it a little more. I wonder why it's hard to say that the Switch is going to be a replacement for a mobile game. You would pick up and play on your cell phone, like you're doing Candy Crush or some sort of like Line 4 Eliminator kind of game. I mean, but Brain Age would crush if they took that approach again.
I think it is an interesting point. Like they've definitely steered away in the past like 10 years away from like that more casual focused software. Like they had commercials, they had marketing for things like Brain Age and Nintendogs. Like if they actually marketed Brain Age, if they made Nintendogs on Switch and marketed it, I think they'd do gangbusters again.
It's been about a year, but I don't know if you guys remember just the heat that came out around the release of Wordle. Wordle is a product of the New York Times, and it is just a little puzzle game with a 5-letter word.
Well, it's
how successful and how many people play that now? Brain Age is that. Mm. Brain Age could just make 20 mini games like that, you know, and it would be a hugely successful. If you think about how many people the New York Times has captured every day, though. I play it every day. I love doing it.
Well, it's a product of the New York Times now. A guy made it,
and then sold it
and made a ton of money. Good for him.
Yeah, well, you know, maybe the NSPD at Nintendo should consider offering this guy a job. And maybe tell him, hey, we had this thing called Brain Age that was really successful back in the day. Let's just put them, you know, the nodes into your brain and find out if we can extract that information from you, and we'll do it again. Yeah, there's like, this series lies dormant.
Mm.
Right?
It's a sleeping dragon.
This series could come back. And then, in 2024, when it's like, you know, Brain Age, Word Buster, whatever.
We'll move it up to the B tier then.
It sells 40 million units.
Brain Age Academy.
We'll have to go into the A tier. We'll need Christian Bale and Matthew McConaughey to come slay it.
All right. I think we both feel bad about putting it at C+, so let's leave it at C+.
Okay. Pikmin.
Pikmin.
Last one. So Pikmin, relatively new, well, 20 years old at this point. Almost,
first one 2001.
Almost 21 years old. Yeah. It has had 4 installments with a 5th one announced. This is a franchise that was close to the launch of the GameCube. We're actually getting really close to talking about this on the Retro Show. Got a sequel also on the GameCube. And then we don't see a new installment until the Wii U. It goes dormant for an entire generation. And we also see a spin-off with Hey Pikmin on the 3DS, which was not well received. All the other games, very well received. I actually don't know how it does on sales.
Not well. Very poor.
One and two, I would not... I probably wouldn't guess that they sold over 1 million. 3 being on Wii U, and then got also a version on Switch. Maybe that was able to crack 1 million. I don't know. As far as recognizability, I don't think that this is a very like
I don't have
unit, iconic series.
I don't have title by title listing, but it sold about 6 million units as a franchise.
Mm.
Pikmin 3 is the best selling, and it sold 2 million units.
Yeah, then that got installments on 2 different platforms. So you're what, loading, what was that, 30% of your sales into the one game, into the most recent game, and we'll see how 4 does. Like it's obviously a franchise that Nintendo cares about because they're finally like doing a sequel.
And they made a mobile game.
Oh, and hey, oh yeah. What was it? Pikmin Bloom is out there.
Yeah, it's so stupid. Yeah, it looks so boring.
We had a couple of guys in the Discord group who play it.
Yeah, it's like a Niantic game. It looks just like Pokemon Go, but just a different kind of
thing. It's more like about tracing your steps rather than...
Yeah, very much about like gyms and big areas that are heavily populated by people, creating these large gardens and Pikmin stuff. I think that there's actually something to be credited for it for basically every 10 years or so, kind of. Or not every 10 years, but it seems like every... They've got, what, like three games, they've announced a new one, and yeah, this, there is this Hey Pikmin thing, but they consistently just release a title, gets an 85 out of 100 review, and it sells a couple million units.
Yeah,
and so it's a self-moving beat. Like, it pushes itself along.
And this, well, and it's also Shigeru Miyamoto, who's the creator of this series.
That's the only reason why it's a disappointment. Yeah, because this big brand, the huge dude behind the company, is like, I love Pikmin, and like, it's great that you do, guy.
And he does. Like, he really loves Pikmin. And I'm 100% convinced that the reason that this series still exists is because, like, he's convinced that this is good and it's something that people should be playing. So I think,
if,
like,
it's selling a couple million, it's covering its costs. Mm-hmm. Again, it's chugging along. It's doing okay.
Yep. I think this is, you want to go point by point? I think I have in my mind where I think it should be.
Yeah, did I have any other points? Oh, we need to talk about, who's the main character of it?
Captain Olimar. Well, depends on the game. Captain Olimar is in 1 and 2. He's also in 3, but not until the end, and I don't think that he's playable. In the third one, you get your three playable characters. Let's say Louis is in the second one. In the 3, it's Brittany, Charlie, and Alf, I think it is.
So they don't even trust him in the third installment to carry his own game.
Yeah, he's their Smash Brothers character.
I was going to compare it to, like, the movie Minions. I understand there's a guy that controls the Minions.
Mm.
I don't know who the fuck that is.
It's Gru.
Okay.
But neither here nor there.
But the Minions. Everyone instantly knows and recognizes them. Minions are the yellow guys and the fucking overalls and shit. Same deal with this. I think the Pikmin are the star of Pikmin. I don't think it's Olimar.
Yeah, yeah.
But still, that's not much there. All right.
Yeah, you show, like, a picture of a Pikmin to people on the street. I mean, you're not going to get too many people recognize it. You show a picture of Olimar, almost nobody's going to recognize
it. Right, yeah, Olimar is worse than the Pikmin. All right, so longevity, I give it a C. I think it's a C. It's been around for 20 years, and it's releasing just enough gaming content to remain relevant.
Yeah, I don't have too much issues with this either. I might go B just because it has been 20 years. So, you know, 50% of the time they've been making games has been around. But, yeah. I think a C is also fine.
Sales, I'm giving it a D.
Mm.
You can't push this game as hard as you do and then not at least somehow have one of these games be a success.
They really do push it, though. There are times where they do a Nintendo Direct. They did a Nintendo Direct like a year after Pikmin came out where they talked about Pikmin. Pikmin 3, specifically. Because they believe in the quality of this series, and people don't line up to buy it, so they felt the need to push it again.
Yeah. We got reception. I give it an A. It's really, it's surprisingly consistent. Every game gets an 85 out of 100.
Yeah,
but they're all like plus or minus one, maybe, but they're all like 85 out of 100.
I think the one exception, like at least in terms of like fan reception, Pikmin, Hey Pikmin, on 3DS wasn't really all that well received.
Yeah.
But yeah, the mainline installments, yeah, always really good.
And the iconography of it, the main character gets a D.
Mm.
I just think it's Pikmin, it's whatever.
For an overall C?
I was going to go a low C, high D.
So below Advance Wars or above Advance Wars?
I think below Advance Wars, yeah.
I'd go C for this one.
Yeah.
And a lot of that is just kind of based on how Nintendo believes in this franchise. Like, this is something that they want to succeed. Like, this is something.
Yeah, I'm not putting up a huge fight over Pikmin. I mean, if you want to put it in a C, I just think, again, we're going to get a little top heavy if we keep, you know.
No, we still got a lot to get through. And, you know, we can move it around. Like, this is one, like, if it was in the low end of C, then maybe it does drop to a D at some point. We'll see.
Yeah. We're probably, whoever this is that we got this idea from, that did it so poorly that we had to redo it ourselves, we're blasting them out of the water with content.
Oh, certainly. Sure. Yeah, yeah.
They're probably just like, oh, it's a fucking...
Earthbound, it goes in the A. And F-Zero, that goes in a B.
Yeah, like, come on, we're gonna really break this thing down.
Yeah, we're sciencing this shit.
Yeah.
So, what do you think? You guys got anything else you want to talk about, or should we pull the plug here?
We've been going for a while.
We have.
Call it.
Okay.
I've been up since 6 a.m. I'm falling asleep.
Okay. Take a nice rest, Wes.
Lost Wes.
Next up is going to be the retro show. This guy's going to be a good one.
It is. A lot happening. A lot of things went down.
Mm-hmm.
One of the greatest games of all time came out, and sadly it wasn't a Nintendo game.
That's okay. We got a lot of different games we'll be able to talk about. I don't have the list in front of me. But
a lot of mass casualty events in real life. Mm. There's like three or four different horrible events that occurred in the wake of 9/11 that aren't about 9/11. Mm. You know, we invaded Afghanistan.
Did not take fucking long, did it?
Yeah.
Didn't take long.
Bunch of movies. A bunch of interesting movies to talk about.
Yeah, the floodgates opened up in the theaters. And
yeah, and there's just so many fucking albums. I intentionally have some that are one sentences that I just need to fucking get out of the way, because otherwise it's going to be too much.
Cool. I've listened to a couple of them.
Much too much.
I'll hopefully be able to listen to a few more before we re-record. And the games, we'll have some GBA games to talk about, and depending on where we're at content with the games on other platforms, maybe we do a quick little preview of the GameCube, because we got a new console launching in November. Here we go.
It's gonna be great.
So, and then we'll wrap it all up at the end of the month with the official show. That's it, that's the end.
So long.
Bye-bye. Thank you.